I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The right-to-work battle has hit the Missouri Senate floor after making its way through the House. If a bill passes both chambers and Governor Greitens signs it, workers won't be required to pay union fees as a condition of employment. Today we look at the pros and cons of right-to-work rules, which could soon become Missouri law. What will it mean for workers and for businesses? Then find out how some Hyde Park residents are taking a new tact in the fight against crime. We'll meet a Good Samaritan who wants to work alongside police to reduce break-ins in her neighborhood. Later, we bring you State House Blend, Kansas. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Missouri State Senate is in the process of debating Senate Bill 19, which looks to make Missouri a right-to-work state, meaning, and I'm quoting from the bill here, employers are barred from requiring employees to become a member of a labor organization or pay dues required as a condition of employment. The Missouri House has already approved a similar bill. What does this mean, though, for businesses and workers should the bill become law, as it's widely expected to do? Here to help explain this are Greg Morad. He's vice president for legislation for the National Right to Work Committee, which backs this legislation. Greg, good morning. Nice to have you.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Pat Duke Dujakovich, he goes by Duke, is president of the Kansas City chapter of the AFL-CIO, which is the umbrella organization for 55 unions and 12.5 million workers in this country. Duke, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Greg, let me start with you. What's happening today in Jeff City when it comes to right to work? What's on the agenda?
Well, the Senate Bill 19 is up for what they call perfection. That is the main session on the floor of the of the Senate, where they consider amendments and then advance the presumably advance the legislation. Then tomorrow it would go to third reading and from there to the governor's desk.
Duke, there's some talk of a Democratic filibuster on the Senate floor. These are fairly rare. Republicans have the power to break that filibuster. Are you expecting something like that?
I don't really expect anything like that. And if it does happen, I'm relatively certain that the Republicans will PQ or call for a previous question, which would kill the filibuster, probably in pretty short order. You know, there is debate, and I believe that probably the leadership down there is going to allow some debate, but they're going to, with the point they think it turns to a filibuster, they're going to end it.
Greg, how does being in a right-to-work state benefit businesses? Just give me the nickel version here.
Sure. I mean, I don't speak for businesses. I speak for employees who don't want to be in unions. But businessmen have told me they prefer to operate in areas where they know that if they treat their people well, those people can't be forced to join a union. They are hoping to avoid a situation where they get locked into one of these contracts where the guy that swings a hammer isn't allowed to plug in an extension cord.
At what point are they forced to join, Greg, from your vantage point?
Employees currently can be forced to join a union as soon as 51% of the workforce in a given workplace votes for the union. The other 49% can be forced to accept the union as their bargaining agent and then forced to pay for bargaining that they did not want, did not ask for, and might think they're better off without.
And Greg, how does being in a right-to-work state wind up benefiting workers?
Well, it benefits workers in a lot of ways. The main one, of course, is that they are free then to choose whether or not the union in their workplace deserves their support. And a good union will continue to be supported, but a bad union, and there are bad unions, will see its support among the workforce evaporate. The workers resign, they refuse to pay dues, and the union either reforms or dies.
Duke, let me bring you into the conversation from the labor standpoint here. How does a union benefit a business from, again, from your standpoint?
Well, the benefit to the business of a union, from our standpoint, is that you get to outsource all of the HR functions. And so we've got an electrical contractor here in Kansas City, and the woman who owned it decided that there were a lot of opportunities for her. And rather than firing up the business, buying the equipment and bidding the jobs, and then hiring everybody to do the work, she decided to sign a contract with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
And that changed her life how?
She's doing very, very well. It's a very successful electrical contractor here. It's one, I believe, it's probably the largest in the state.
Because you guys handle the human resource functions? Explain that to me.
So basically, the unions hire, and we train. And then we also, if there's any requirements of additional training or safety training, that's done through the union. And that training is paid for by the union members. Those who are working pay so much per hour into the apprenticeship fund, and we fund the training of our own people.
And then, Duke, how does a union wind up benefiting workers again from your viewpoint?
From my viewpoint, look, this is, we live in an at-will state, and that means that you could be fired for any reason, for no reason. There are certain protected reasons you can't be fired based on racial discrimination. But in Missouri, it's still perfectly legal to fire somebody if you find out that person is gay. And so what the union does is it protects workers and makes sure that everyone is treated equally. Everybody is treated fairly.
Give us a range, if you would, Duke, of what yearly dues to a union can wind up costing a worker.
One of them, so for general laborers, probably, and some of the service employee unions, it's around $20 a month for the very low end. At the high end, I know of one union, and the last time I knew it was about $110 a month.
Wow.
And so it does vary greatly, but unions provide services to their members. It's just like the government provides services to its citizens.
So it's a few hundred bucks a year to
No, I'm sorry. That's per month.
Per month?
Per month, yes. It's 20 to 100.
For a year, it's a few hundred bucks to maybe 1,000 or two.
Correct.
Okay. Greg, let me come back to you. Just as workers have the right to vote a union in, they can vote a union out as well. Why doesn't your organization push for workers to do that?
Well, we help workers whenever they want to do that. The reason that's not sufficient is because the process of getting out of a union is so onerous and burdensome compared to the process of creating one. Mm. It is far more difficult to have a decertification election. The bar is much higher, and it's much easier for the existing union to interfere and to continue to file what they call blocking charges to prevent that election ever happening.
Duke, do you buy that?
No, I don't. There are several ways. Like, we see it consistently. Kansas is right to work and has been for a very long time. We're right on the border. A lot of our unions cover both sides of the state. Public sector employees have right to work currently, and so firefighters don't have to pay union dues. There's also the ability for a member to opt out of paying dues and pay lower agency fees that only go towards what the services that member gets.
Okay. I also wanted to ask you, Duke, the law requires that once a union is voted in, it becomes not only the bargaining agent for all the employees, but it must also represent all workers, union members or not, in matters of employment disputes. How much can that cost for a single case, Duke?
Well, it can be as simple as filing a grievance for a non-dues-paying member and settling that with a simple meeting of a business agent or a house steward that can go to a manager, and they can settle it right there, and it can run all the way up to arbitration. Once the administrative reliefs have been exhausted, usually the last one there is arbitration, and that's court. And so that's hiring an attorney, and basically it's slightly less than a full-blown lawsuit, but it can still run into the thousands and thousands of dollars on a single case.
Hmm. Are there any serious efforts to change that part of federal law that requires unions to represent all workers?
That's, you know, changing the federal law and trying to change people's lives that way causes more problems, I think, than to be able to just deal with it and try to show value to the members and why they should support the union.
Okay.
If I could interject for a moment, I have to take exception to the premise that they are required to represent everybody in a bargaining unit. That is only a requirement if they assert the privilege of what they call exclusive representation, what we prefer to call monopoly bargaining. Once they do that, they take away the individual worker's right to represent himself, and then they assume the burden of representing that guy. But if they were to form a members-only union, bargain with their employer on behalf of only their members, and not try to bargain on behalf of all of the rest of the workforce, then they would assume no obligation, no duty of fair representation to those other people.
Duke, respond to that.
I have no desire to take care of only a certain section of the workforce. I want this to be all of us. It should be fair. It should be across the board. And if I get something, you should get the same thing. We are more of an all or nothing kind of organization. If you look at the
Do other labor unions adhere to the same philosophy?
Most of them, the ones that I know do, yes. Mm-hmm. And if we look at like the defined benefit versus defined contribution pension plan, if a 401k, I would arguably have more money if I had my own 401k and I was able to invest it in the way I saw fit and I did well. Instead, we decided nobody was going to retire rich and nobody's going to retire poor. We're all going to take exactly the same regardless of what the market does. We all contribute in. We all take one fair share.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about one of the hot issues before the Missouri General Assembly right now, which is Missouri Right to Work. This notion that employers are barred from requiring employees to become a member of a labor organization or pay dues. It's been a hot issue in the state for a number of years. We're joined by Greg Murad, who's vice president for legislation for the National Right to Work Committee, and Duke Dujakovic, who's president of the Kansas City chapter of the AFL-CIO. Greg, you know, 2 years ago, and this is one of the big issues that has surrounded Right to Work for so long now, the nonprofit, nonpartisan Economic Policy Institute updated a 2011 study comparing wages in right-to-work states with those in non-right-to-work states. It showed median wages are about 17% lower in right-to-work states. Greg, why does your organization work to pass laws that would wind up resulting in less pay for workers?
Wow, that's not a loaded question. Let me begin let me begin by disputing your initial false premise. That is that the EPI, Economic Policy Institute, is nonpartisan and that they have not a vested interest in this. They are almost entirely funded by unions and the AFL-CIO. So that is a biased study, not an unbiased study.
Is that true, Duke?
I've never written them a check. I don't know.
Okay,
you haven't. Look, follow the money. That's where it comes from. Nevertheless, statistics I've got studies on one side, you've got studies on the other side. I can point to studies done by the National Institute for Labor Relations Research that shows that the average worker in a right-to-work state after you factor in cost of living is actually a couple thousand dollars higher in purchasing power in the right-to-work states over the non-right-to-work states. It costs a whole lot less to live in Iowa than it does in New York or California.
Duke, respond to this. What's your sense of what happens to wages in a right-to-work state?
Wages in right-to-work state go down. And you can say that the cost of living also goes down, but so is the quality of life.
They go down. Why?
Why do wages go down?
Yes.
Because there's nobody there to speak for the group, for the masses. I mean, individuals are not able to negotiate on their own. They can also be pitted against each other quickly and easily. And so we continually see that. The rights, constitutional rights, to a trial by jury is taken away by a lot of employers, and you're forced into an arbitration only, or you're locked out of the merit increase system. And that's a case going on right now here in this area.
Let me ask both of you, you know, as Greg probably astutely pointed out, there are numbers and studies on both sides of this issue. Do we really know the answer? What the financial impact in a right-to-work state? Duke, you go first, and Greg, I'll give you a shot afterwards.
There have been studies done by economists, but as Greg stated, they're on both sides, and it depends on who's paying for it is what study you get. Now, you can get some that are pretty impartial, done by, like, here at UMKC, there was a study done here on the economic impact of right to work, the economic impact of prevailing wage, all of those things kind of go in. But for every single job gained in a right to work state, I can show you jobs gained in right to bargain states. Harley Davidson chose to come to Kansas City, Missouri. Mm-hmm. They could have clearly went right across that state line.
Greg, what's your sense? Do we really know the answer to this question of the financial impact to a worker in a right-to-work state versus one that's not?
Well, I think we all agree at this point there are studies on both sides. And again, non-biased studies theoretically on both sides. I can point you to some from the George Mason University Economic Department that show the numbers that I was talking about, average worker actually being better off. In terms of where the jobs go, there's not much doubt that the right-to-work states are outperforming the non-right-to-work states in terms of job creation, and the population is following those jobs, which is why you see stories like we saw a couple of weeks ago out of New York, massive net out-migration overall from the non-right-to-work states into the right-to-work states. Those people are following the jobs. Sure, some jobs are still being created in the forced due states, but it is there's no doubt. I mean, those numbers are clear, and they're straight out of the government jobs reports that creation in the right-to-work states is significantly higher.
Greg, let me stay with the money question. Where does the Right-to-Work Committee, your committee, get its funding from?
We are all funded entirely from donations from private individuals and businesses that believe in our work.
Like who?
We guarantee all of our donors complete anonymity because a number of them, rightly or wrongly, fear that if our donor list were out there, bricks would go through windows, tires would get slashed, and equipment would get vandalized.
You know, PR Watch,
our donor list is entirely confidential.
PR Watch pointed out once that some of your money comes from the Koch brothers, the Walton Family Foundation of Walmart fame, the Coors Family's Castle Rock Foundation. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure where they would have gotten that, certainly not from us. And I again, will never confirm or deny who may or may not be a donor to us.
Okay. Duke, let me come back to you here. It can be said that unions drive up the cost of running a business to the point that companies wind up moving to countries where labor costs are less. How do you counter that argument, which you've heard a million times?
Yeah, I'll definitely answer that question, but I would like to for full disclosure, I'd like to tell you guys where my money comes from.
Sure.
My money comes from janitors. My money comes from Alex Smith. He's the quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs. And indirectly, my money comes from the president. Donald Trump is a union member, and he gets a union pension.
And your money comes from Alex Smith of the Chiefs because?
He's in the NFL Players Association. They are a union. The referees are in a union. The guy selling beers in a union. Tech Nine, the rapper in Lee Summit's in a union.
Okay.
Donald Trump's in a union.
How about this notion of unions driving up the cost of running a business?
Definitely, without a doubt, we do see increased costs where we see organized workforces. But we see a better quality product, we see a better business model, and we see a community where the people make enough money to afford their own housing, to afford to buy their own food, to afford to have their own health care through their employer. And where we see that, we're not paying for it on the other side.
And Duke, a better quality product is a result because why?
A better trained, higher educated workforce.
Greg, you buy that?
Well, I have a number of exceptions I could take with everything Duke just said. The main one, of course, is that the increased cost you see from the union participation is not higher wages. It's the lack of flexibility, where a guy that swings a hammer can't plug in an extension cord. You end up having to hire twice as many people because there's easy things that guys aren't allowed to do. And so that kind of loss of flexibility and the loss of the flexibility to adapt to changing market conditions is the single highest cost of unionization. Now, that said, I'm not here to argue that unions are bad. Some unions are good and some unions are bad, and
right.
Some companies are good and some companies are bad. There's bad actors on both sides. That's why we believe it ought to be up to the individuals who know best, the workers in that workforce, whether or not that union is doing a good job.
What about claims, Duke? And again, you've heard this, that even though a worker doesn't have to join a union, that he or she winds up getting pressure to do so by union members who are already in the workplace.
You know, without a doubt, and you got to define pressure. I mean, saying, hey,
you know what we're talking about.
Yeah, I know, but
come on.
We're not, you know, when we're talking about the inability of a guy to swing a hammer to plug in an extension cord, that's ancient. That's antique. There are composite crews on construction sites right now. That doesn't go on. The pressure used to maybe be, there may have been some physical stuff went on in the past. There's no way that's going to happen now with lawsuits
peer
and
pressure.
Litigation.
What's the atmosphere like in a union shop when you're trying to get other folks to join?
If peer pressure was able to change that, we would not have anybody who didn't pay their union dues. There is pressure to do the right thing. There are people who say, hey, listen, you should contribute to this. You should do the right thing. But when they run any kind of charitable contribution, there's peer pressure. United Way campaigns assert some type of peer pressure. Anything at work, donating at work, or whatever happens, birthdays.
So you're saying the pressure is no greater than a United Way campaign?
I would say probably about the same. If the majority of the people in your office are contributing to a charity, any charity, there's pressure for you to contribute to that charity. And if you are not, then I think there's going to be some peer pressure on you. And I'd say it's probably about the same. I've not seen any physical violence, any threats of violence, any type of pressure exerted on a regular basis because it's not allowed.
Greg Murad of the National Right to Work Committee, what do you hear on that front, that question about pressure?
Well, a number of our clients would beg to differ, and I could probably introduce you to them, Duke.
I'd love to meet
to us because they've been abused by not always the union officials, but often by people in the union, and they would allege that at the urging of the union officials, that again is one of those things that we are constantly litigating.
I'm wondering, Greg, why shouldn't non-members pay a fee? I mean, if they're benefiting from the contract, then shouldn't they, shoulder part of the cost for the union negotiating on their behalf?
Well, you know, they might disagree that the contract is a benefit to them. So they might want to work better, harder, smarter, and get rewarded more under a merit system, but they can't because they're stuck with that union contract. A young employee might prefer to have an extra dollar an hour versus a gold-plated health insurance system that pays for $20,000 elective procedures, which is what I heard from one union member in Indiana when we were passing the law there. So the union contract is not necessarily a benefit. And again, that's why we think it ought to be up to the individual.
You know, a final point here, Duke, right to work has a real effect on the biggest tool in the union's toolbox, and that's the strike. Explain that to me.
Well, you can't really go on strike, especially when, you know, any place you don't have the full support of the workplace. It's just not going to be effective. But any, you know, I go back to this.
But does right to work undermine your ability to go on strike?
Only increases the number of people who might be inclined to cross the picket line.
Mm-hmm.
But I go back to this. Strikes are also another thing of the past. We haven't seen strikes in a very long time here in the Kansas City area.
Yeah.
It's you know, we're not organizing by going in and forcing votes anymore. We're organizing by going in and showing the value.
Greg, a final point to you. How is it possible to look at the work the National Right to Work Committee does and somehow not conclude that it's a move to break the unions in this country?
It has nothing to do with breaking unions. Right to Work makes for stronger unions because it adds a better layer of accountability of the union officials to the union membership.
Let the unions figure that out. You know, I don't think we need a bunch of millionaires and billionaires telling Missouri what to do.
Okay.
Our members aren't millionaires and billionaires. They're rank-and-file union workers, too, who just don't want to be there.
We're going to leave our conversation there. Greg Murad, Vice President for Legislation for the National Right to Work Committee. Duke Dujakovic, President of the Kansas City Chapter of the AFL-CIO. Thanks for a civil, educational conversation, gentlemen. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to turn to the Hyde Park neighborhood of Kansas City and its efforts to fight crime. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we recall the life of Royals pitcher Yordana Ventura, and the film critics reviewed the latest indie, foreign, and documentary films prior to today's Oscar nomination announcement, and we also heard our critics' recommendations for predictions for Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress as well. You can go to kcur.org/up-to-date for a list of their recommendations. Tomorrow on the show, we'll learn about Langston Hughes' childhood over in Lawrence and about a collaboration between the Kansas City Symphony and one of the most performed living composers in America. That's tomorrow on the show. Well, faced with a wave of break-ins in their neighborhood, Hyde Park residents in Midtown Kansas City are looking to take matters into their own hands. The residents are considering a series of options, including volunteer patrols of their neighborhood. If a potential crime is spotted, residents and those patrols would call police. Other options under consideration include hiring private security or purchasing surveillance cameras. Turns out the idea of volunteer patrols isn't new. Hyde Park residents used them back in the 1980s. Today, a conversation about an historic neighborhood seeking to reclaim itself. With us, Ruth Schmidt is the Hyde Park resident who's been asking her neighbors if they're interested in starting a neighborhood patrol. Ruth, thanks for joining us. Good morning.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on, Steve.
Kathy Disney is also with us. She lived in Hyde Park for 33 years and helped organize a volunteer patrol back in the 1980s. Kathy, good morning to you as well.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Ruth, what prompted you to ask your neighbors about forming a neighborhood patrol, and what were residents experiencing out there?
Yeah, last fall, there were a string of break-ins, and I think there was one specific week where every single night there was a break-in, and my home was one of them, and I was home when it happened, and that experience I will just never forget, and it fueled in me a desire to get the neighborhood talking to each other. You know, there's so many people that live in Hyde Park, and there were just a few thieves that were basically making all of us live in fear. And
what was your experience? What happened at your own home?
It was about 2 a.m., and I was there by myself, and they got in through the window, and I started to wake up when I heard them coming up my stairs. And since then, I've purchased a security system, so that's good. But
well, that's not too scary, is it?
Right, yeah.
How did you deter them?
As I heard him coming up the stairs, I got out of bed and slammed my door three or four times to my bedroom just so they were aware that someone was up there.
How are residents in Hyde Park reacting to all this, Ruth, all this outbreak of crime? What are you hearing?
It's a fantastic group of people. The more I walked door to door and met over 100 neighbors with a fellow neighbor, Troy Batson, and most people are really eager to be engaged and to help in any way they can.
Anybody moving out? Anybody that discouraged?
There were a couple, I think. Yeah. It's not for the weak of heart, but for the most part, most people are love that neighborhood and they want to see it get better.
Well, let me bring Kathy Disney into our conversation here because, Kathy, you're a former Hyde Parker, as I mentioned in the intro here. When did you live there?
We lived there from 1983 until just a couple months ago.
And why did you leave?
We've raised a family in Hyde Park, loved being city dwellers, and we're both in our early 60s, my husband and I, and kind of time for a different view, Chapter 2 house to age into. So we moved to a ranch. We moved from a four-story house and decided to kind of, find a house we could age into.
Well, you helped form a volunteer patrol of the citizens back in the 1980s. How did that come about, Kathy?
Kind of similar to what Ruth's experience is. A lot of sitting on the front porch talking about what's happening in the neighborhood. Hyde Park has always had a very strong neighborhood association. And I believe it was Valentine Neighborhood was starting to do a volunteer crime patrol. And they had been working with the police department, and we went over and talked with them and decided that it was something we thought we'd try in Hyde Park. And we had over 100 volunteers, and I was the scheduler. And I've scheduled over 100 volunteers. Most nights we had two shifts running. Lots of nights we only had one. But we had two people per car, and that was kind of for checks and balances, too, to keep an eye on one another. And we had, magnetic signs that went on the sides of the cars. We had an old school at that time. It was early 80s, so we had a phone in a suitcase. It was a car phone or a mobile phone. We had a spotlight that plugged into your cigarette lighter and a police scanner so we could hear what was happening so that we could be eyes and ears. And we worked with the police department very closely. And the biggest thing, Steve, that whole experience for many, many years allowed residents was it provided them a vehicle to jump on and be involved in and feel like they were making a difference.
And Kathy, did it work?
Yes, it lowered crime. And it, like I said, more important than that, I think it made people feel like they were doing something.
And you could document the reduction in crime? You could see it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, every month we would meet with police and we could see where it was reducing crime. The fact that we had eyes and ears out there and we were visible deterred it.
Yeah. And now, Ruth, you're considering doing something very similar. What do you have in mind and where are you in the process right now?
Well, actually, I got the idea from Kathy. She reached out to me and we connected after I had posted on Facebook that I was going to walk around and meet neighbors. And so there are three options right now that we're considering. One is picking back up that volunteer patrol and copying almost exactly what they did 30 years ago. The second one is hiring a patrol. I think Rock Hill neighborhood pays for a patrol right now, and so I've been talking to some people in that neighborhood.
That can't be cheap, is it?
The price that I've been quoted is about $1,700 a month. There's such a wide range to that, though, based on the hours that patrol officer will be in the neighborhood. So I'm sure that price could go way up if you wanted them there all the time.
Mm-hmm. And what's the other option you're looking at?
Yeah, and then the third one is installing cameras. And the Roanoke neighborhood has done this basically on light poles, big signs that say this neighborhood is under surveillance and you have a really large visible camera, hopefully to deter crime, but also to catch it if it happens.
Do you have any sense from your neighbors, Ruth, what direction that Hyde Park will probably go in at this point?
Well, I sent out a survey before the holidays to 100 neighbors asking them their level of interest and participation. And what I found is that people don't have as much of the time as they would like to volunteer for a volunteer patrol. But most people are really interested in donating financially to help it happen. So for me, the conclusion I've come to is probably the cameras are a better bet just because that matches the interest level and what people have to give. And so right now I'm in the process of writing a proposal to take it to the Hyde Park Neighborhood Association. And the goal is to receive partial funding from them and just work really closely with them and the police to make sure that we're doing this the right way.
Kathy, I'm wondering how long back in the 80s that your volunteer neighbor patrols, how long did those last?
Boy, they lasted a long time. I handed it over probably after a decade, and I know it went for another 5 years or so. It went probably a good 10, 15 years.
And if ultimately went away because?
I don't know the answer to that. I wasn't involved at that time when it disbanded.
What about this notion Ruth just raised about the time commitment and whether residents are willing and able to sort of devote the time to something like this? How did you manage that when you were in charge?
Well, we had, like I said, we had over 100 volunteers. So it typically you'd only have one shift per month. So that was like a three-hour shift once a month, and that was not a problem for people. You know, only one person would go, so if they were married and had kids, somebody would be home with the kids, so it wasn't a hardship. And, you know, back then, everybody was pouring tons of money into those houses. They were all apartments, and we were taking them back to single family, so I think people were probably more willing to give of their time than their money at that time.
And just to be clear, you guys weren't packing heat, right? This is a different kind of patrol. And tell us what you did.
No, I made it. That was one of the reasons I reached out to Ruth when I saw her interest on Facebook, because I was like, you got to really be clear with your volunteers that this is eyes and ears only. You're to stay back. You're to report what you see. And you're just to be a visible symbol that people are watching in the neighborhood. And, it was very clear. The police worked very closely with us of what our role was.
Ruth, this idea that it's just 3 hours, you know, every number of weeks, as Kathy just pointed out, that doesn't sound like too arduous of a schedule.
Yeah, I was hoping more people would be interested. But to be fair, I didn't send out a survey to the whole neighborhood. So there could be people that would be more interested. I just haven't met them yet. But from what I've seen from that survey, money is just a little bit, it's got a little bit more money than they have time right
now. We're talking this morning about rising crime in the Hyde Park neighborhood and what the neighborhood's doing to band together to fight it. 816-235-2888 is the number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. And Kathy and Ruth, we have an email here. Resident and land owner of 10 properties in Hyde Park just called our producer, Danny Alexander, to say cops never respond in a timely manner, even when told who's committing crime. No prosecution results. What about that?
That's a pretty rigid statement, I would say. 33 years in that neighborhood, I've seen great response time. I've seen delayed response time. I understand what the police are doing. And, a lot of it is how you call it in. And that has not been our experience. Our experience has been that things are prosecuted to the highest degree. The detectives that follow up after the police have been involved are very professional and very thorough.
Ruth, what's your sense of how the police are doing in your neighborhood there? How much cooperation you've gotten?
Oh, I think they're doing a fantastic job. And I think it's important to remember that there are two patrol officers assigned to Hyde Park. And Hyde Park is a huge neighborhood. We run from 47th all the way up to 31st. And for those two officers to cover all of that space and the amount of crime that we experience, they have their hands full. I have a lot of respect for them. And I think there's also this misconception that with the rise of crime, it somehow is due to negligence on the part of the police. And I think it couldn't be any further from the truth that we have officers who are very committed and really would love to work with us and are looking for neighbors to be more engaged and to decide they're going to put some effort into this instead of just being passive.
And Ruth, just so I understand, if the police are that cooperative, why do you even need to look at alternatives to supplement what they're doing?
Yeah, I think it just comes down to the number of patrol officers that we have. We only have two.
Right.
That's just the situation that we're dealing with right now. It doesn't mean that those two aren't doing a great job and like working their tail off.
Right.
But that's the reality.
Kathy?
And I'll add to that if I can. Back in the early 80s when I was real involved, it was community policing was the beginning wave, and it's still around. So it's a good thing. It works. You've got people, you know, I was a stay-at-home mom, and then I ended up working out of my home. So I was one of few people on my block that was home all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you've got people like that that are eyes and ears, seeing things, finding out what's suspicious and watching for it, and, you know, being block captains and communicating to the rest of the people on your block when something happens, so people, you know, remember to lock everything up, even
right.
when they're home, and just stuff like that. So it takes a whole community. We can't depend on the police to be everywhere and see everything.
Right.
That's on us.
Let me go to Chris, a caller here who I think is a resident and landowner in Hyde Park. Chris, good morning.
Good morning. I called in at least four times to two different mayors and at least a couple different police captains. We are just on the border on truce. We're facing truce. And literally, when we have someone doing...
Chris, make your comment brief because you're real fuzzy.
Okay.
Our reception with you on your cell, I guess, isn't working real well.
We have repeat graffiti and theft. And when we call the police, when people are caught in the act, they do not come, period. It's been this way for years. So
okay.
I'm glad to hear it's not that way for everybody, but it is for a lot of us. So.
Again, Ruth, it sounds like you're having a different experience yourself.
Yeah, and I think I caught most of what he said. If he was talking about graffiti and
right.
calling that in, I do also want to bring to everyone's attention that there is a wide range of crime that happens, and graffiti is actually not high up on the list because of where we're at in the city. There are much more serious crimes that they're looking into. So that, you know, I'm making a judgment call here, but I think that might have something to do with the delay.
Right. Ladies, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. I'm going to want to stay in touch with you all about what you decide to do. Ruth Schmidt, a Hyde Park resident, looking at what her neighborhood can do. Kathy Disney, who lived there for 33 years, helped organize a volunteer patrol back in the 80s. Thank you both very much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank
it's a pleasure
you.
Being with you all.
You bet. It's no secret that the Kansas state budget is in shambles. This week, State House Blend Kansas features someone who is intimately familiar with Governor Brownback's proposal to fix it.
Introduce yourself, please.
Sean Sullivan, State Budget Director.
Joining Sean and me today in the KCUR 89.3 production studio is my Kansas News Service and KCUR colleague Jim McLean. Jim, always good to have you here.
Great to be here, Sam.
Jim, jump in here. What's on your mind?
Sam, I'll tell you right off the top, one of the things I'm interested in, I've been talking to a lot of legislators, and you know, Don Hynum and the new majority leader, we were talking to him the other day, and after you gave your budget briefing, there are some legislators, and this is will be of no big news to you, who were in search of a quote-unquote structural fix to the Kansas budget problems. And they're not sure the budget you and the governor presented, you know, is that fix. They think there are still too many kind of quote-unquote smoke and mirrors elements to it.
I think the majority of the returning legislators and certainly the newcomers are coming in having heard the message from the voters that we're tired of these smoke and mirrors games of trying to patch together a state budget. You need to fix this mess.
Just objectively speaking, is there some truth to that criticism?
Depends on what you count as a structural fix. Our goal was that by the second year of the budget, which would be what we call fiscal year 2019, that there was more annual revenue than annual expenditures. So take out the one-time fixes with what we proposed with tobacco securitization, and that there would be more revenue expenditures. I will say, admittedly, we did not count the highway transfers as part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not just because it's occurred for several years. And at a minimum, I think the highway fund, CAPERS, there's a couple of things that I know that have received a lot of criticism and will be a hard road to go for legislators to vote on. But if we're not doing at least those two things, it's going to be a very, very long session.
Again, smoke and mirrors. I mean, that's a member of your own, of the governor's own party. You're facing enormous headwinds, are you not, in the legislature with this budget that you've proposed?
I greatly respect Majority Heineman. I think he's doing a great job and willed this session. Yes, there are headwinds, but at the end of the day, there aren't going to be any easy choices. Our primary challenge right now is that our revenues, tax collections, are growing at a very anemic rate. It's been 12 times less than what they historically have over the last 25 years. So no matter what happens with taxes, whether they're raised $50 million, $500 million, $1 billion, we're still going to continue to have difficulties over the next couple of years because of the way our economy is structured and because our tax receipts are growing at 0.3% a year. So that makes it very hard to craft a budget. We did the best we could with trying to look at all the different factors that go into it and put together what we felt like was a reasonable proposal that by year two we felt like was on the right track and structurally balanced.
I do think for the listeners it might be helpful to tick down real quickly some of the elements in your proposal. You mentioned the tobacco securitization idea, and that is there's this tobacco settlement that the state, you know, crafted with a bunch of other states back in the 90s to settle into lawsuit against the major tobacco companies, and we've had an annual stream of revenue coming from that sense, and that will continue into perpetuity. What you're proposing is to sell those future proceeds for a big lump sum of cash right now to help pay down the projected deficit, right? So you've got that. You're trying to borrow from it, liquidate a state investment fund, borrow from it, and then pay it back over time. Your pending payments to CAPERS, a lot of things like that, right?
Those were the major components that I knew would get or have a lot of heartburn. So what I tried to present last week was, okay, if you don't do these items, then here's what you're looking at. You're looking at a $900 million shortfall in fiscal year 18, and that would require $900 million of taxes or $900 million of cuts, which would be 16.5% across the board cuts, including to schools when there's a Supreme Court decision that's impending across the street from the Capitol, or a mix of the two. And even if you do a mix, that is $400 million of taxes, $450 of taxes, $450 of cuts, and it's just an extremely difficult scenario.
So I think you know that one of the things they are going to do, if I had to bet today, is to repeal that business tax exemption, the so-called LLC exemption. That seems like it's pretty much a done deal just reading the tea leaves. Will the governor veto that?
You know, from being around, the governor very rarely issues veto threats. He's very deferential to the legislative process from having been a congressman, senator for so long. So I think it would depend on what comes out of the committee, what that looks like, what the conversations are. As was signaled a day or two ago, he's certainly open to a compromise and looking at it. He's never, he's always been open to that, I think. So he's not one to set a policy in place contrary to, I think, what popular opinion is, and then not be open to evaluating what it needs to, how it needs to change or what it needs to continue to look like.
How deep do you think they're going to dig their heels in trying to make sure that CAPERS is kept whole at this particular moment? Are you expecting a big fight on that?
I think it'll be hard. I mean, I totally get what the heartburn's about. The reality, though, is when you look at the payback schedule for the, when you look at the total CAPERS system, even in a very good time where you're getting healthy tax receipt growth from sales, income tax, and major tax categories, it's going to be very hard for the state to be able to meet those CAPERS obligations as they are set now, of trying to pay off the past sins of past legislatures and past governors. So what we proposed was, let's add 10 years to the payoff schedule. So instead of paying it off in 2033, let's pay it off by 2043. We felt like that's reasonable because other states have done that. Also because the CAPERS Board of Trustees, within the last few months, lowered their assumed rate of return on their investments, which increases the amount we're required to pay. So let's stop, let's reassess it and figure out where we need to go. When we look at what the other factors are, when we look at the impending Supreme Court decision, policymakers' unwillingness to go and reduce K-12 spending, when we look at the reductions made to Medicaid already of 4%, when I already have 8 to 10% of reductions to almost every other state agency besides K-12 and Medicaid. I mean, it's hard to go and do more at this point during the fiscal year.
In Kansas, the Medicaid program is known as CanCare. And a couple of quick questions for you on that front. You mentioned that about midsummer, you cut reimbursement rates, essentially cut Medicaid or CanCare by about 4%. Again, it's one of the things the governor did to respond to the projected shortfall at the time. There's a great deal of desire in the legislature this year to restore that cut. The governor has proposed a way to do that in his budget. What do you say? I mean, is it likely that one way or the other that cut will be restored this year, even given all the other problems?
I think there's consensus among legislators that I've talked to and leaders on the health respective health committees that they would like to do that. I think the governor put out a proposal. We're certainly open to other options, what they want to do, if it's not his, if it's something mm-hmm. else. I think there is a great desire to go and restore.
And the reason 4%. This is an important question, I'll just insert this, is that there's a concern now, and this leads to the next question, about network adequacy. In other words, there are these three companies that care for people in the CanCare program, and when you cut reimbursement rates, people tend to walk away from the program, doctors, dentists, et cetera. And so there's a concern about maintaining those networks up to federal requirements. And toward that end, the federal government has just informed the state that it isn't going to approve an extension of the CanCare program for the coming year because of those network issues and some other things that the reimbursement cuts contributed to. That order comes down on the very last days of the Obama administration. So will it stick? What's the feeling in the administration?
I would say that the timing of it's not a coincidence. While there are many, many issues that need to be addressed and improved at KDHE, whether it be eligibility, whether it be with access to networks, as
yeah,
you mentioned.
The backlog, the networks.
All those things, there are many things that need to be improved. I do think this was a political shot across the bow by the Obama administration.
Before we get out of here, I just want to ask, and I'm serious when I ask this, you doing okay?
I'm doing great, yes. Thank you. Thank you, Sam.
Kansas so, nice. Yeah. That's Sam's ass.
That is exactly. Sean, as you well know, this is where we turn the podcast over to you. As I remember, you had a lot of input before selecting AC/DC as your walk-off song when you were here last time. And so I'm most eager to hear what you've chosen for today.
Without editorial comment, I'm going to throw out Ozzy Osbourne and Crazy Train.
You can't beat that, especially at the beginning of the legislative session. State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. I'm Sam Zeff. See you around the radio.
You can find full episodes of State House Blend Kansas podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, be sure to subscribe to State House Blend Missouri as well. Tomorrow on the show, we'll explore the childhood of Langston Hughes in Lawrence, Kansas. We'll hear about the KC Symphony's latest recording and collaboration. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tadakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.